This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Brooke Simons about her memoir. It's called Nothing to Write Home About, subtitled A True Story, which it is. How are you, Brooke?
I'm well. Thank you, David. How are you?
I'm good. It's really nice to get to talk to you about this book. I think it is always, you know, in some ways, it's challenging to read somebody's true story because, you know, unlike a novel or a piece of nonfiction about something distant from the person, there's all these, you know, it's your real life. So, you know, you always worry as an interviewer, you know, you don't want to overstep your bounds. But I thought this book was really incredibly honest and I think extremely brave of you to do. And I wanted to ask you about first, before we talk about you and your life story and your history, just a little bit about that notion of what does it take to put yourself forward in a public space, in a public way, when things that you're writing about are not necessarily beautiful or wonderful or stuff that you'd be proud of. You know, there are things that are painful and things you did that you're uncomfortable with or unhappy about. Well, I don't want to say that, but just, you know, that expose you as a younger person that this book is about.
Well, that's a good question. I waited over 30 years to tell this story because it was embarrassing and humiliating and something that I kept in a closet. But when I wanted to wait until my daughter had graduated from high school for one thing, but I also started working with a lot of younger people. And I realized that not telling my story was selfish. And if I told it, perhaps there might be a girl out there who would read it and might make different decisions than I did. So I decided to go for it.
Well, I think that's sort of what I guessed, I think. And just as a little background, you wrote this. This is about the time when you were in your 20s and you came to Los Angeles, where you live now, from Connecticut, near where I think both of us grew up, in a very similar geographical environment, similar place. We know the places we each grew up in pretty well. And you wanted to be a screenwriter when you came to Los Angeles, and you fell into this stand-up comedy scene, which at the time, I mean, it's actually a pretty interesting period. I think, you know, television shows, movies have been made about it, books have been written about it as a, you know, a kind of this amazing period of time, the late 70s, early 80s. But it was also a time that was kind of on the cusp or pre, you know, like feminism had launched, and the, you know, there was a great deal of empowerment for women that started in the 60s and came into the 70s, but it wasn't like the patriarchy was gone. And so you ended up as a young woman with all of these really kind of unpleasant men. And a lot of this is about your relationship to one or two of them in particular.
Right. Well, to say that it was the flip side of Me Too. It was so different than it is today. And I think that a lot of the guys that I hung out with were just troubled and talented. But there's a fine line between trouble and talented and abusive, being physically abusive. And I was so besotted by the talent and the world and the opportunity to be around such talent that I overlooked a lot of warnings until it was a little bit too late.
Do you feel like, you know, and I sort of self analysis is always difficult to do, but do you feel that it was your a sense of insecurity of your own abilities and not believing in your self-worth as a creative person that enabled you to become enthralled in a sense, to become in the kind of willing partner with a person who was going to abuse you.
Well, I no, not at all. I felt that I was on a magical journey, and it was just kismet that I had met Biff Maynard, and he was such a brilliant writer. And the whole purpose of our meeting was to allow me the chance to learn how to write comedy, and that would be a terrific thing to skill to add to more, my portfolio. And I just decided to stay because I didn't know when I'd get another chance to be around that kind of world without being a performer myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think it does. I mean, that's why
See?
I said it's hard to do self-analysis. It's also hard and kind of unfair, even for a reader, someone who wasn't there and is experiencing this through your memory, the lens of your story, to make judgments. I think judgments are not really fair, but we tend to do them. We tend to make them anyway.
But yes, I mean, I was completely and utterly insecure about being a female and who to be and what I was supposed to do. I mean, the women's movement came along at a really interesting time when, when I was growing up, everything changed. You were supposed to get married to a nice person and have a nice life, and then all of a sudden you were supposed to get either a professional degree or have a fabulous career. And the fabulous career idea was something that at that point I was pursuing with a vengeance, but I didn't really get how to be a girlfriend or who would be a good quality man to be with. I don't think I thought I deserved better than what I got.
Yeah. Well, I wonder in thinking about that particular time. So you were born in 1951, same year I
50,
was, 50. Okay.
1950, yeah.
So this is the late 70s, and I think in some ways it's fair to say that because the expectations of the previous generation were not our generation's desire to participate in. We were not, but there was there were no, there wasn't a guide. There was no sense of, well, this is how you live your life. You had to figure it out. And I think a lot about, if you read about the political movements of the 60s and 70s, the male-female relationships are very similar to what you describe in the in Hollywood, in the performing arts and television movies, where the hegemony of men was not moved by the changes that were occurring. It was too early in the political, social, economic process for for the changes that we see today to, they just weren't there. They hadn't happened yet. So it was the culture was still catching up or was still behind the political discourse. And so a lot of the people that you experienced were, they were old-fashioned men, even if they didn't realize they were, and the way they treated.
Right, and they were right, and all of their dads were dads that were coming out of the, the 30s and the 40s. So, and yeah, and there was, I mean, it was a direct link. There hadn't been any dilution of that, that notion that there's things that men get to do that women don't, like laundry. You get to do laundry when you're a girl, but you don't have to do it when you're a guy.
Right.
And there were, and also there, there was a lot of class distinction too, because there was the whole notion of bitch work of, you know, I don't do that. And it's just so different today when you see, you know, dads pushing strollers and dads being full partners. And it's just such a huge, huge leap from the way that it was then.
Yep. Well, you know, I thought of this just now. Do you know the show Stranger Things? It takes place in the 70s, almost the same period that your story does. And when I forget the woman's name, who is the high school kid who is working in the local newspaper, and the whole newsroom in this small town, there are a bunch of guys. They're all sitting around being guys. And when she comes in to talk to them about a story, they laugh at her. You know, her job is to serve them coffee and to go get them donuts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is literally an expression of what you experienced with these guys, you know, these stand-up comedians.
Yeah. I mean, and there wasn't any stigma about it. I mean, that there was nothing wrong with making a joke like, you know, the best size woman is a short one with a flat head so you can put your beer on her. I mean, you know, and being one of the guys and creating yourself so that you wouldn't be hassled and you wouldn't be harassed and you wouldn't be noticed and you could just be a fly on the wall and take notes seemed like an okay thing to do then.
Right.
So now you would be like, yeah.
Right. But I think that's part of what I thought was really powerful about this story for a reader of today, whether you're our age or younger, that you were willing to show what happened to you, that you were part of, you know, you were part of it. It didn't just happen to you. You allowed it to happen because of the time frame, who you were, all of that. But I think that's part of what makes this book so powerful, is that you were willing to expose yourself in just that way.
Well, you know, I think for me, I had four older sisters, and they were, in my opinion, princesses, and they all did the things they were supposed to do and wore prom dresses and joined sororities and went to colleges that, you know, were like Mount Holyoke and so on. And then all of a sudden, when the first wave women's movement hit them, they started doing things like not wearing makeup and not coloring their hair and not being princessy and being first wave feminists. And for me, that was like, okay, wait, I have to come up with a different plan now. And so it seemed like being around that world was like going to the college that I didn't go to. And I don't know. I don't think that we were, I mean, it was true that women weren't funny, and there were hardly any women doing stand up, and there wasn't really a place for them to do it. But I wasn't really thinking about that. I was thinking more about just sitting in the back of the room and taking notes. And you know, there was a certain amount that I was willing to trade for that. And the problem is that your decisions start getting cloudy when you start adding cocaine to them.
Well, I was going to bring that up. I thought that that also is a kind of marker of that period. And of course, I don't know very many people who've experienced that much cocaine, but you certainly were part of a very heavy scene where it just seems to have been everywhere with all of those people.
Right. And you know, and it's a sneaky little drug. But the best thing about it for a girl of that era was that it completely killed your appetite and it made you skinny. And, you know, we grew up in the Twiggy era, and the more anorexic that you looked, the better. There was no such thing as, you know, being curvy or being, you know, body positive. You had to be sort of deathly skinny or you didn't or I didn't consider myself attractive. And it was a very workable drug. It let you have many waking hours during a day, or so it appeared.
Right, but it was also, I mean, it was fairly, even though those days are different than now, it was still expensive in relation to how much money you might earn from a job. So it ends up that you got kind of sucked into becoming involved with dealing, which is also, you know, kind of an interesting story. And without giving away too much, this is, you know, kind of like it became a really big deal for you because you were doing this without realizing the risk, I think.
Well, you know, there's a saying that something like what heroin doesn't do to you in 6 years, cocaine will do to you in 6 months. And it's a fast acting destroyer. And, you know, it's like I look back at that period of my life and there was nothing similar to it really before or after. And the inability to think clearly while at the same time you feel like you're thinking clearly is remarkable. And by the time that I made a very stupid decision to sell cocaine to supply my boyfriend's cocaine habit, it made sense at the time, but this to a girl who said I would never, ever, ever do that in my entire life. So I think part of the reason that I wrote the book was to really try to understand how that particular decision was made. What steps had to happen? How did the descent happen? How did I find myself almost at the bottom of a rabbit hole without even knowing that I'd stepped foot over the edge?
Yeah. Well, I think that shows, I mean, I think you succeeded in at least illuminating that. I think that it's hard, even secondhand, to understand how that evolves, but it does. It's pretty clearly, you just make, it's like, I think it's what they call the slippery slope. You don't notice it as you get farther and farther down the steps into what we might call disaster or hell or whatever, the pit. I think that's true as we look at politicians today who make, who give up their souls little by little to accommodate.
Right.
And then all of a sudden they find themselves actually participating in evil, in bad decisions and things that are really inhuman.
Right.
It's a similar thing, but they don't have the excuse of a drug.
Right. And ambition in its own right verges on not evil, but with very little help, it can become a negative force. And I really find it interesting that, you know, when I was in my teens, there was this list of things that I said I would never do. And one of them was, I would never take acid. I would never let a man hit me. I would never sell my body for money. And I would never sell drugs. And, you know, I got 2 out of 2. So, but those, you know, those were like serious, serious commitments on my part. And, both the physical abuse and the legal abuse were on parallel tracks. It's like, well, you know, when it happens once, you should walk away, but it's really not, it's not that easy. It's not that uncomplicated.
Right. I think it's like, it's easy to say, but hard to do.
Yeah. And one of the other motivations for me wanting to write that particular story was that I think I've spent so many years listening to reasons that didn't ring true to me about why women stay in abusive relationships. And I didn't think that I'd read a story about a woman who explains that that there are reasons for staying sometimes, and they're calculated, and they're not always smart. And oftentimes, you know, one of the things with domestic violence is a lot of times they are fueled. It is fueled by, you know, alcohol and drugs and whatever. And you do make decisions to stay that you might not make if you had a clearer mindset. But you still make those decisions. And I mean, for me, so much of my reason to stay and keep staying was I did not want to be removed from that culture, period. You know, I'm a tough girl. He hit me. So what? It was just a smack. I've got two brothers. So what? You know, I can dodge it next time. I'll just not be so stupid next time. I won't say anything so dumb next time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was very really powerful to read that, to kind of think about it and pause in trying to understand how that happened. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the fact that you used real names in this book, and the person that you talk about that was, you know, that you were in a relationship with who hit you and who really, I think, mistreated you in a lot of ways. You asked him for permission to use his real name, and he gave it to you.
Right. Well, many years after the fact, when I was married and a mom and all that, and when I decided to write the book, my husband, who's an intellectual property professor, said, you can't write that without getting his permission. And he said it would just be, you know, a safer thing for you to have that. So he wrote a life rights agreement and gave it to me. And I drove across the desert to Las Vegas, where Biff Maynard was living, and met him after 30 plus years. And he was an old, sick guy, and he signed it. And I had no idea who the person was or what he'd become or who he used to be, or why I would have ever been with somebody like him. But he signed it. I think he had an ego, and, you know, any press is good press, you know, and then he died.
So what do you think he has had memories of that period? I mean, it would be so interesting to have been able to interrogate him about that period and what he was thinking and how he looked at it. Do you think he would have been able to be honest about it?
Well, we talked about it. We sat around his little table and talked about it. And he looked back on that era with great fondness, and he was just delighted that I was able to, you know, survive and resume my life and my place in society and marry, you know, an upstanding fellow. He didn't, there were no apologies. I think he felt that I was on a mission to discover my dark side. And I was probably the 20th girl that had asked him to escort them through that process. So I think there was a part of him that felt a little bit annoyed that he'd been put in a position of having to be violent. I know that's really hard to understand, but it's sort of like there's a sick piece of at least of my story, that I felt that I needed to be hit long enough and abused hard enough until I got to the point of saying, wait a minute, I'm not bad. You know, that I had to be pushed hard enough until I could stand up and say, no, I'm a good person.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had not.
Yeah, that's the part that people don't talk about. That's the part where when somebody's hitting you, there's like a divine correctness to it, because you knew all along that you were a piece of shit. So you deserve to be hit. And thank God somebody's finally recognized that you're no good. Hmm. And that's kind of a little bit of the dirtiness that isn't really a discussion point that's popular.
Well, it's hard to hear it as a, you know, for you to say it to me, I find that it's hard to hear.
So, mm-hmm.
You know, it makes me feel bad. It makes me feel bad for the person who is so in need of that. It makes me sad. I have to say that, you know, for that person.
Well, and that's why, you know, domestic violence, why the stats are so interesting, that it cuts across, you know, it's not about race, it's not about class, and it's not about money. It's really about, I think, how, at least for me, you, when you're young and you have a dad or a parent that makes you feel less than, you don't rage at them. You just learn to kind of feel bad inside of yourself.
And it's that,
I think it's the spirit of survival that causes you to stand up and leave. But it doesn't necessarily happen right away. I mean, typically a woman has to try and leave a man 7 times before she can actually get her strength together,
right,
to do it. And the more that you're hit, the less strong that you are. So I look at what happened to me as just a complete affirmation of my value and my strength, and being able to stand up and just say, you know what, sorry, I was wrong. You know, when I met you, I did need somebody to break me, because I was, running too fast and too scared, but now you've done it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's right. The transformation is important for all of us. You know, you have to, I mean, that's what makes it powerful, I think. But it's really, it's great that you came through it without being really damaged.
I don't want to give away what happens in the book, but I think I was aided by, we'll call it an intervention of sorts that abruptly stopped what I was doing. And I had not had that not happened, I might be dead. I really, really understand how women think they're going to leave and say they're going to leave, and they stay just one time too many. And then when they do run, they have nothing left of themselves, and it takes so long to build them back up. And you know, when you escape in the night, when you run and you go to a 45-day emergency shelter just to catch your breath, you don't just wake up on day 45 and say, oh, you know, I'm now prepared to go get a job.
Right.
I've suddenly resumed control of my my sense of self.
Right. No, it's
true. So I was, yeah. But I was, you know what, I have no regrets. I was basically a rich kid who had a kid who had resources, a kid who didn't need to go to a shelter, a kid who, had parents that let their child fall all the way down to the bottom and said, you know, we still love you anyway. Here, have another chance. Have another go at it. We'll finance it.
Yeah, that's important too. That they were there for you, that you had family who would support you and help you. You are not completely alone. That's really a big part of the story.
Right. I mean, I don't feel that I earned the right to a pity party in any way. I was really, really lucky to be able to drive across the country, to have a car that I could drive across the country in, and to come here and you know, fall on my face. Floundering is expensive.
Yes, this is true. And now as a parent, I can say I understand how parents feel when their children go through difficult times, when you can't intervene and stop somebody from doing something, but you have to be there for them when they need you.
Right. Yes, but when you have floundered yourself so badly, there's a fear of, you know, that your child might go through the same mm-hmm. thing. And that's, you know, that's something that for me that I just have to keep a bridle on. You know, it has to be okay for your child to fail. It doesn't mean that they're going to go down for the count and have their life almost ruined. It means that, you know, they didn't make the swim team, you know?
Right. But that's yeah. such a fine line for a parent, because you want to save them, you want to help them, but you can't, if you do it too much, you're harming them even more.
Right. And if you spend $250,000 to jack their SAT scores, you've probably stepped over the line.
That line I could recognize pretty fast.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, okay, we know you love your child, but, yeah. So it does make the parenting thing interesting. And then having to come clean with my daughter and tell her, I mean, the first time that I told her my story, she was, I think, 14. And it was a brief synopsis, but I didn't want, you know, I didn't want anybody in my family in some boisterous Thanksgiving, you know, storytelling to talk about my story before she knew it from me.
Right. I think that was smart of you to do that. But I think then I think you were also right to wait until she was older in order for her to accept and understand your story as an adult rather than as a teenager.
Right. And so many years had passed and values had changed that she was sort of like, yeah, and, you know, like, wait, like who, lots of people do drugs and have bad boyfriends. I didn't go into the abuse part of it. I just went into the drug part of it. But she was my first, not my first reader, but I told her that I would not publish that book unless she signed off on it. You know, and my husband too.
Right. Right. I think it's a testament to their faith in you and their belief in you that they were able to do that.
But it was, I mean, it was so weird. You know, I live in this town that is, I don't know, we have a women's club and it's affluent, and there are all of these women that I sort of spent my mom life pretending to be of, but I thought, oh my God, if they ever knew who I really was, they would, you know, they would just cast me aside. And when the book came out, somebody interviewed me for the local paper, and then the women's club, which I thought was the most snitty of the clubs, read my book as their book club group and had me, you know, come and talk. And I was just so touched that they asked. And, you know, everybody has a story. Everybody has their story. And it's never, I thought what was going to be so hard was telling the truth about who I was, but it didn't matter at all. And I could have used my married name.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful that you did this. And it's great to hear that you feel good about it in your friend circle as well. So, well, I want to thank you, Brooke, for talking to me. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Brooke Simons about her really, really wonderful memoir, Nothing to Write Home About. And it really is something to write home about. Thank you, Brooke.
Thank you, David.